Somebody I've always looked up to in radio was John Robbie.
He came by to see us. After some time off the air, we discussed what it's like to leave radio and to leave the impression that he did on so many South African minds and hearts. We discussed how John had transitioned from rugby player to radio presenter. He told a number of really moving and quite humorous stories a lot of the way. He also spoke about the incredible things that happened from there and the people that came into his life. It was just really honest and I suppose a little bit indulgent because it was me talking to one of the guys who I really respected in radio. And to have John sit down for over an hour and discuss things with us was excellent. CliffCentral.com. John Robbie, everybody, is here. How are you? You don't look like you've aged at all.
Oh, you lie like a cheap carpet, Gareth Cliff, eh?
You had already aged by the time I met you.
I feel like I've died and I'm attending my own funeral.
Oh, dear.
Great to be here, Gareth.
It's great to see you. I don't think so. When I spoke to you on the phone the other day to invite you here, you sounded like a man who's discovered a whole new lease on life, a whole new energy.
Yeah, it's called fear. I'm scared. I'm out of my comfort zone. You know, I've a friend of mine, a very good friend of mine, a guy called Peter Doyle, I was chatting over Christmas about what I'm going to do next. And he said, your problem, John, is you're institutionalized. And I am. I'm like a prisoner. Every morning, 2:15, right. Get into 7:02 just as the 3 o'clock news is ending. 3 hours preparing, do the show, post the show. But you know, everything was so regimented, and now suddenly I'm sort of on my own, trying to find out what I'm going to do, and it's I don't know, liberating, but it's also quite scary.
How has your body clock been adjusting since you no longer have to wake up?
Do you know that is the question every single person asks me? When you announce you're retiring after such a long time, three things people ask you. First thing they say is, were you pushed? Did they tell you to go? Were you fired? No, I wasn't. I went to them and said, look, I'd like to move on. The second thing they say is, are you sick? Are you dying? That's the next thing they ask. And then the third thing they say to you is, do you still wake up at 2:15? I do. And funnily enough, I was at the cricket on Saturday as a guest of Dr. Ali Bacher. And he said, you know, John, you're going to do it for the rest of your life. When he was a young medical student getting up to go to Barrow Hospital, he used to get up at a similar hour. And he says to this day, he still does. The difference is now I can turn over and go back to sleep, which is
isn't
fantastic.
It the best feeling in the world?
It is, yeah. Second
God.
Best.
You know, yeah, right, fair enough. You know, it's a funny thing. Being a morning guy in radio is it's a whole different way of absorbing the world. You're up before everybody else. You're getting to grips with stories they'll only open their eyes and pay any attention to much, much later. So you kind of feel like you're ahead of the curve in some ways, but you're so exhausted by the middle of the day that all you want to do is sleep, and you're useless to anybody. And people want to schedule meetings with you at 3 p.m.
yeah.
And all kinds of things, and you just want to hide away in your house and not have to do with anything.
Yeah, it's a strange existence. I think my biggest boast, and I've said it before, I think altogether it was about, I don't know, 17 years doing the morning show. Dan Mayani and I did it at one stage, and then myself on and off, and I was never late once. I was never late. I never slept in once, which is a heck of an achievement, you know.
Unbelievable.
Just like you, Gareth.
I did it. I did it last week.
And can I tell you, that's one of the reasons why I was outside here at 6:30. I thought, imagine if you've boasted all this time on 7:02 and then I was late for Gareth Cliff. You know, that would somehow just be crazy. And yeah, that's it. Fear of being found out as well. I think that's also it. I think there's a something that my former a friend of mine have often talked about. It's called imposter syndrome, where you've done something for a long time and you're considered quite good at it or whatever, and inside there's always that tiny fear that you're going to be found out, that somehow people are going to say, my goodness, you're not good at what you do. And I think it's called imposter syndrome, afraid of being an imposter. And I think that fear of that coming up is perhaps what led me to prepare to over-prepare. And some people say I did over-prepare. Sometimes I wouldn't use 80% of the stuff that I'd prepared, that I'd scripted, that I'd laid out. I mean, forests in Brazil have disappeared because of the preparation that I did for the morning show. And yet it was worth it. And I learned it all from a guy called Alan Jones, a very famous radio man in Sydney. He used to work for 2GB, 2UE, and then moved to 2GB. And he is the best, not in terms of his views, which are very different from mine on many things, but in terms of radio technique and preparation, he was the greatest, I think, in the world. And I'm a very simple guy, so he used to get in at 4 o'clock in the morning, so I said, I'll get in at 3 o'clock in the morning. And that's where it all started all those years ago.
Well, Gareth began by sharing his perspective of having worked for you shortly. So on a scale of 1 to 10, how useless was he as a producer?
I went through producer, and I must say, in fairness to Gareth, that in the early years when you know 702 went from a sort of a rock and roll music station, irreverent, to talk radio overnight. You know, talk is, it was over a bottle of whiskey shared by your manager, Rena Brunberg, and Stan Katz, one of the legends of radio. So we sort of made it up as we went along. And of course, I was here, ex-rugby player, thrown into this, and there was very little to go on. We literally made it up as we went along, and we were living through these historic times. And I was very tough. And again, that fear of failure, fear of being found out. And I think of some of the producers. Then, as we got better and the figures started to rise and the revenue started to rise and we got better at it, I'm a lot more relaxed. You wouldn't believe I'm such a pussycat now. But I remember Gareth Cliff at one stage reading the weather on the show, where he didn't come on as Gareth Cliff, but he came on as a farmer from Donkerhoek in Pretoria. And was fantastic. I mean, I don't think anyone picked up that he wasn't this Afrikaans farmer with some, you know, I don't know, a little bit of grass coming out of his mouth, whatever. And so that was a memory from many, many years ago. But Gareth, you've done very well.
Yeah, thanks, John. I think you know, we tend to look forward most of the time, and we don't really take enough time to look back and to see how much we've done. And in your case, you say it's going to your own funeral, but really it gives you a chance to kind of look back and see how much you have done and how much you've contributed to the way people feel, the way people think, to the way they understand their environment. And if nothing else, and occasionally make people laugh, occasionally give them something to look forward to in horrible morning traffic. And that in itself, if that's all you've done, that's enough. You know? but there is so much more. And it must be quite gratifying to leave before they kick you out, to leave before your career starts to go down, to leave before people can start doing what they're doing to Barack Obama now and analyzing and criticizing and trying to make a meal of your legacy. It's nice to be able to do that on your own terms, which is what you've done.
Absolutely. And the last show, I mean, well, I had this last show. It was quite weird because I'd been overseas and then I was to come back for a week and I had a farewell at the station. Then I had to do this
You didn't have a voice.
Yeah, well, that's the point. And the reason I didn't have a voice, I'll tell you why, was I had a bit of a cold. And then, man, you know very well, Tolani Gwala, who took over from me and is doing a magnificent job. I must say, I can hear the work that's gone in. He suddenly, I think, realized the magnitude of driving a morning show on a radio station as opposed to an important show like the afternoon drive, because a morning show, you know, every radio station stands or falls on that, and it's like having the weight of the station on your shoulder. I think Delaney realized, hang on a second, in a couple of weeks, I'm doing it. And so he said to me, can I meet you for about half an hour? So I said, sure. And we went across to the news cafe in Sandton. And 3 hours later, we came out and he talked me dry. He'd picked my brain. He'd absolutely sucked the marrow out of every bit of radio I knew. And that's when I realized he's got. But the end result was my last two shows, I was croaking and husking. And I think everyone thought I was in tears.
Well, I spoke to him and he said that was his plan from the beginning, is to reduce you to a heap so that he could come in and seem to be very good.
But people were so nice, you know, and I'll let you into a little secret. The 702 said to me, look, John, just don't prepare anything. You know, it's you've had this relationship with people who love you, who like you, who put up with you, who tolerate you, who hate you. You you know, like sure. everything. And that's the way it works. And you've got to accept that. And they said, don't prepare anything. Just go on the air, open the lines, and it'll be a nice way to say farewell. And my producer, Nonko and Amel were there in the last show. And I was quite nervous and a little bit emotional. And I said, do you think there'll be calls? Genuinely, this fear, you know, that no one is out there listening. And from
you're just so difficult to be, it's so hard for you to be happy.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. And Relebo Chile, who goes on beforehand, her show is just inundated with calls. Yeah. And for 3.5 hours, well, half an hour before, half an hour afterwards, and 3 hours, the lines were absolutely jam-packed. Not a call was set up, nothing. And then at the end of the program, when the Minister of Finance called in and just said thanks. And you know, he is a man for whom I have the greatest respect, and I think one of the great heroes of this country, and that story will be told in future. For him to phone up and say, well done, that was absolutely terrific. But you know, nowadays I listen to Trelawney, and there's still a side of me thinks that's my spot, and it's hard to realize it isn't anymore.
But these changes are also inevitable, and you got to sort of roll with the punches. I mean, you had an incredible move in your early life from professional rugby,
amateur rugby. Right. Well, we did a little bit,
sure, but you played for some very very big teams, you know, and to go from that into radio was a transition which nobody would have anticipated, least of all you.
Yeah, I mean, I played rugby for Ireland, for the British Lions. Yeah. I came over here, I lost my, just stupidly, I'll say it now, absolutely, you know, I think we were mad to come on tour here. But yeah, young amateur rugby players, businesses being done in the country.
A chance to... What the hell?
Sportsmen have brains. Sure. They're supposed to have brains as well. But anyway, I came over here and then came for a year to because provincial rugby here was semi-professional. I played amateur rugby. I thought, play for a year here, have an adventure with my wife and young son, who's now given us 2 grandkids, you know.
Congratulations.
Young Johnny, who you'd remember as a little kid running around. He's now a lawyer living in London. And we thought we'd come for a year. And 1 year led to 2 years. And suddenly I'm on the bench for the Springboks and I'm playing for Transvaal. And it's all very exciting. And then I fell in love with this country. And then one day I got this phone call from a guy called Chris Gibbons. I listened to Radio 702. Yeah, Chris Gibbons with that coughing, clearing of the throat. And
hello, John. Would like to offer you a job.
Young Robbie. I was a listener to 702. I was driving down Simmons Street one day and I heard this program about people doing impressions of beavers mating or something. And I'd never heard anything like this before. I've died and I've gone to a different planet. And it was John Birks. And I discovered Birksey and discovered he was a Transvaal fan. And I used to phone into the station. This is long before phone in. I mean, we're talking in the 80s now, the early 80s. And I used to phone in and speak to him and Kevin Kelly, the late Kevin Kelly, who was his engineer. And then 702, which was this rock and roll, irreverent radio station with a lousy signal. And of course, Radio 5, 5 FM started in opposition with a fabulous signal. So 702 was under a little bit of pressure. And one of the things they said was, well, why don't we get sports players on to do, you know, sort of celebrity sports reports, as they do in American radio stations. And somebody said, well, who can do it? And I'd phoned in a few times. I'd done a bit of commentary when I was injured. And next second, I was in to do sport on 702. And the minute I started, I fell in love with it. I went full time after 2 years. I did a sports program in the afternoon where we took calls in from listeners. You know, radical stuff in those days.
Absolutely.
Gareth, this was unheard of.
Right. I mean, people used to wear a tie and do the news in a jacket. They would. I remember I went to his funeral a couple of years ago. Dennis Smith used to tell me about how at the SABC they would have to wear a suit and tie, and they would sit in front of the mic, and someone would play a little xylophone. They'd go, it is 7 o'clock and time for the news.
Dennis Smith.
And then they'd go into the news, and it was this formal present. Even though no one could see you,
You
had to be formally dressed, and you were addressing the people
of the
nation.
BBC. You see, copy the old BBC. Right. But I mean, it wasn't quite
so
like
for
that.
For you as a rugby player, come on, and to be colloquial and to talk about stuff with real expertise and real experience, this was unheard of.
Yeah, I mean that was where it started. It was fun. I was doing that. I was working for a company called National Trading. At one stage, I was selling high tech stainless steel centrifugal pumps to senior engineers. I mean, it was
did you know what that was?
Doing present. Well, I learned more from selling to engineers than I did from two universities.
Wow.
You know, it's just that ability to look people in the eye who think you're a piece of something the dog has brought in, and yet you know inside, you know more about your little area
right.
than this god does. And that was actually a fabulous training for talk radio. And then 702, ups and downs, et cetera, et cetera. Then they announced they were talk radio, and they were suddenly looking for people who could do talk radio. And I'd done talk radio on the sports side, and I was becoming more politically aware, etc. And then they said to me, would you like to do – David Blood was doing – you remember David Blood? Mm-hmm. He was doing a talk show in the evening, 10 o'clock till midnight. I mean, a graveyard shift if there ever was one. And they asked me – he was on leave to do a week, and I did a week and had the most amazing time and got into rows and ructions. I so told some lady from Benoni to shut up. Oh, you know, it was just the way I would argue in a pub with mates. For me, it was a week's fun. And then I went overseas to see my family, and I got a phone call from Chris Gibbons, who says, we've had a little bit of reaction to this, your week on the radio. If we offered this full time, would you be interested? And I thought, well, you know, maybe I'm getting more aware of talk radio. Sport is not the big game as we move towards the new South Africa. And I thought, yes. So we started off on talk at 10.
When was this?
This was in, well, I think,
early
on the
90s?
26th of January, 1990. And I did my first show 10 o'clock till midnight, and it was no holds barred, and it was people phoning in. It really was good radio.
But as you say, the timing was immaculate.
A week later, FW stood up. Yeah. 2nd of February, 1990, and announced that the new South Africa was coming. Everybody was unbanned. You weren't allowed to mention the ANC. You weren't allowed to talk to people. It was insane. You weren't allowed to do anything.
It was criminal. You'd go to jail.
Exactly. Yeah. That was the country.
And if you did it on radio, they'd have a special eye on you.
And then a week later, the world had changed, and there was this funny little vehicle late at night. 10 till midnight. And the crazy thing was, I mean, it took the country by storm. I think our listenership went up 3,000% in the first month. I mean, it was just crazy. It became the show to listen to. We had Joe Slovo on, the first legal interview he'd given in 30 years, this devil incarnate for the whites, most white South Africans. He came on. He was, you know, fantastic, wonderful, eloquent, spoke about the future, democracy, etc. My problem was, being new, I thought this was what talk radio was like every week. I didn't realize we lived in this talk radio Valhalla. Otherwise, I'd have asked 702 for an awful lot more money.
Now, I mean, to have had access to the people who were writing the blueprint for a new country, and at a time where there was so much to talk about, and there was such real danger, too, the stakes were so high.
It must have
been exhilarating.
Well, I mean, there was really a low-grade civil war going on, if you think about it. And there was possibly another civil war with right-wing groups, you know, the AWB, who used to get 50,000 at the Voortrekker Monument. And there were dreadful things being done in the country. And I mean, it's only recently that I met Eugene de Kock, Primeval.
Yes.
And he was coming up for parole. No, it's over a year ago now. And of course, he had done these terrible things. And he'd gone to the TRC, given full disclosure, but he'd murdered a guy called Yapi Maponya. And the TRC had said this wasn't a political murder, and he'd gone to jail for 250 years. And in jail, he'd realized that what he'd done, he'd been used by the apartheid regime. He had shown remorse, he'd given complete disclosure, and apparently had helped all the family. So I raised on 702 that, you know, despite the terrible things he's done, maybe this guy should be considered for parole. And a guy called Professor Pete Krokamp from UJ, who's a political professor, phoned in and said, well, look, I actually know Eugene de Kock. I see him in jail, and he is doing these things. What you said is right. That's why we support his parole.
Dangerous thing to do. I mean, you've taken a lot of risks in your career as a talk show host, because most people are not, they're not astute enough, they're not sensitive enough to the idea that just because you give someone space to tell their story doesn't mean you endorse
Let me finish my story. I said to Prof, could I speak to Eugene de Kock? I don't know what made me do it. And he said, oh, I'm not sure. And a week later, I got the call, would you like to meet him? And I went up to a tea room in Santon site, like an old tea garden, which I didn't know existed. And all the prison people were there, and the NPA people were there, and Eugene de Kock was there. You know, the same, stockier than he is. And I went up and met people. That's right. Yeah. And they said, well, let's go over there. Introduced, handshake. Let's go over there, but 50 meters away, we can sit and have a chat at the table. And as we walked, me, Primeval, and Professor Krokamp, Eugene de Kock, I thought he coughed. And he spluttered. And then he started to laugh. And he started to snigger. And then he started to laugh out loud. And I thought, the guy's bonkers. And we sat down at the table, Primeval.
Like a Bond villain.
Yeah, like a Bond villain. He's laughing. There's tears coming down his eyes. And Krokamp says, go on, tell him. And he said to me, in the 1990s, I was told to murder you.
Jesus.
With a crossbow. Two senior police officials came in and told him to murder you. And I mean, then the hairs of the arms went up. And I said, well, what happened? He said, I told them to F off. He said, I didn't kill people because of a different opinion like you had on the radio. I killed people who were planting, etc. And that's when I got a hell. And it was an amazing 2.5 hours chat we had with him. But in a funny way, I talked about the guilt that I feel for touring as a rugby player in the old South Africa. And you know, that's something I have to live with. But in a funny way, the fact that the regime at one stage considered having me killed for what I'd done on radio, I thought in a way that was quite cathartic. And in a way, you sort of thought to yourself, well, at least I must have done something that was right. But it was a very interesting moment, I can tell you.
It's chilling. Chilling. You've met some amazing people.
Yep.
Do you ever become friendly with, do you ever get close to some of the people that you interview? You start off, your first meeting with them is perhaps on the air. And then you end up becoming great friends.
Yeah, it's
rare, but it does happen.
Yeah, I think so. When I say great friends, I don't think house friends, you know. Mm. But someone like, I mean, my ultimate hero in life, Archbishop Tutu.
Yeah,
you know, he came on the radio, and it was the most extraordinary interview. You know, it was the days when, not on morning radio, when you have the luxury of the long interview. You know, the morning you got to the short interview. I had a long interview with Archbishop Tutu, and we hit it off. And we became great friends over the years and had, you know, there were times together, even as recently as a couple of months ago when somebody was in trouble and I got in touch with him. And this person who was in trouble, a religious man, I won't go into details, Archbishop Tutu phoned him up and said, you know, you're doing the right thing, and prayed with him, etc. So those sort of relationships with some people. And there have been a few. I often don't talk about them because, you know, that's a sort of a personal thing. And other people, of course, I would not cross the road and pee on them if they were on fire, put it that way.
Yeah. It's been an amazing thing to me to see also that you're very protective of and careful of maintaining an arm's length distance between the audience and the job you do for them, which you take very seriously, and keeping your family and your wife and your own relations separate from that. You were always very clear about that. That was always something that was very important to you, and you've done it immaculately. Somehow you've managed to do that in a world where everybody's business is everybody's business.
Well, you know my wife. My wife,
she's phenomenal.
I mean, we've been married for nearly 40 years. Yeah. Can you believe it?
And congratulations.
And she's lovely, and she's a very private person. And that was something I mean, even when I do mention her, something comes up. She gets embarrassed by it. And I've been very, because in the early years, I mean, you know, she got abuse, and we got threats, and, you know, death threats. And at
again,
time,
for your opinions.
Yeah, for my opinions. And, you know, even the kids, when they were little tots, used to get issues at school, and people say, saying things. So, I mean, that's something you've got to think about. And of course, in this world of Twitter, thank God there was no Twitter or social media or whatever, which although it is the most wonderful thing, there is something evil about it. You know, something that brings out the worst in just about everybody. There's got to be something wrong with it. And yet the strength is the weakness. The weakness is the strength. So how do you deal with it? I don't know.
I remember something that happened with you this last year, 2016, which to me illustrated how everything's changed, because you are rock solid and you are dependable and you are consistent. That's one thing I don't think anyone would disagree with. So John Robbie applied the same principles that he applied from the very beginning of his career when you were this controversial
communist.
Yeah, and people were calling you all kinds of names then, and you weathered the storm. you might even have been killed if Eugene de Kock had had a bad day.
Yes. Yeah.
You went through the 90s where everybody was in, everything was in flux, but you had a certain idea about what was right and wrong. You got into the 2000s, you continued with criticizing things that needed to be criticized and praising things that needed to be praised, but you held your line. And then somewhere in the last part of last year, there was the most innocuous thing about black hair.
Pretoria Girls High. Gosh.
And about girls who should be or shouldn't be allowed to have their hair worn in a certain way. And you proffered what you had always done, an opinion, an uncontroversial one, by the way.
Mm.
And all hell rained down because suddenly this mob of social justice warriors on Twitter who started to become so self-righteous that they felt they were ready to criticize everybody and anybody saw a nice ripe target in John Robbie, a man who hitherto had for them been untouchable. And they unleashed a fury on you, which I think hurt you in a way that you hadn't been hurt before because
yep.
you weren't used to this.
Yep.
Not from
yep.
the people that you really been talking to on the show every morning, from the people you've been a part of the lives of. It must have struck you as a very strange feeling.
It's one of the reasons I'm leaving. One of the reasons, definitely. I mean, it was this issue about hair, et cetera, et cetera. And the girls at Pretoria Girls High were protesting, and it became this great issue and touching so many bases. And I made the comment, I mean, what do I know about hair? I don't have very much myself. What do I know about ladies' hair? What do I know about black ladies' hair, if I can use that term? But as usual, you're bouncing around an issue and somebody came on talking about it. And I just put the question and said, well, you know, what about standards of neatness, etc.? And I used the phrase, and one of the problems with social media is that you can use something on radio where you're talking, and yet people then take a transcript and every word is analyzed and how it comes across, as though you'd written a manuscript.
Except they don't listen to the tone.
Now that's a very important thing, Gareth. Because a lady came on and she was very feminist and very, I think, of Indian extract. And she was explaining the whole issue of hair. And she said to me, and you as a white man don't have the right for an opinion. And I said, well, hold on, there is freedom of speech, etc. And I said something like, some hair is over the top and showbiz, thinking of some of the things you see, outrageous hairstyles. And that got taken, that John Robbie says all black women's hair is over the top and show. And next second, Pandora's box was open and the hounds of hell were going. And so I trended for 2 days. And I didn't worry about it. I trended for a day. I didn't worry about it until things started coming out. Said, you know, there were things on Facebook and Twitter saying Josh Robbie is a bigger racist than Penny Sparrow. Mm-hmm. Now, Josh Robbie, I've been called many things in my life, but never Josh. So you realize. And what really bugged me was editors picked this up as a news story because it's in a section of Twitter. And it just went. And it wasn't so much that, because, I mean, I'd handled far worse in the past. But I just thought, if I stay on in radio, given the situation we are in the country at the moment, given the crisis of leadership we have in the country at the moment, given the fact that people in the media, as well as being ruthlessly fair and balanced in terms of recognizing achievements, we have to be tougher. We have to be tougher on people who are abusing their authority. And I thought to myself, if I do my job properly. After that, Jenny said to me, my wife, because she's my biggest critic. Gee, you think I got to, you know, when we do program reviews, etc. When I come home and my wife's listened in the gym, I get it in the neck. And she said to me, you know, you're going soft. You can't go soft. And I realized if I don't go soft and I'm suddenly thinking everything, That same allegation is going to come through again and again. Mm-hmm. And maybe if you believe in transformation, which I do, maybe it's time that 702, a black present, we've guys waiting, brilliant and talent waiting to come through. I said, it's not that I'm frightened of it, but I'm going to run into more issues like this, which will sidetrack us from the real issues.
Yeah.
And given the fact that I've been 30 years on radio, I want to do something else. That's when I decided to stop. But the great thing was, Tuli Maranzella phoned into the program and she said, John, you know, can I talk to you? And I think she meant come and have a cup of tea. Because I was hurt. I went on the next day and I was very hurt. And my producers, God bless them, said, well, why don't you come on air? And she came on and talked about unintended offense, and also talked about oversensitivity because of issues in the past.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was a fantastic program, and I learned a lot from it.
But what nobody knew at that time, and what's become very clear since then, is that we were in an election year, and there was paid Twitter. There were people who were actively engaged.
Is that right? See, I don't know about these things.
Yeah, this has all turned out. It's the same bunch of people who went after me when I said my comments about freedom of speech, and they thought I was defending Penny Sparrow. There is an element of Twitter that is paid for by nefarious political agents who, and this is not conspiracy theory.
It's
out there that these people are hired to stoke fires and to create controversy. And if they can distract people who have real concerns about service delivery, people who are unemployed, who have proper reasonable problems in their lives, they need to try and solve. If they can distract them by throwing them into an argument about hair or race or the beaches or some South Coast real estate agent, they will. And it works.
You used a word there, Gareth, tone, because I did a lot of self-searching. And, you know, give and take, you're trying to be devil's advocate. And you're always pressed for time on a morning show on a commercial radio station like 702. So when I was talking to this lady, I listened back and the tone was hectoring. That was the problem. The tone was hectoring. And as a result, and I thought back to an infamous interview that is now something I'm hugely embarrassed about. And that was the interview I had with the Minister of Health, Dr. Manto Shabalala Nsimang, over her AIDS denialism. And it ended up with me nearly getting fired from, in fact, I resigned from 702.
You called her Manto and she insisted on being called the minister, but actually she just ran out of arguments.
But the tone of the interview was shocking.
But John, that's sometimes your tone. Maybe it's some of the reason.
You see, this is where I've also realized, you know, you make mistakes, and I've made every mistake in the book, etc. And I think the tone is so important, because what it does is it touches so many emotional levers from the past that it can also distract away from the real issue. So the Manto issue, I mean, I just thought, let's be less formal. You know, I called everybody by their first name, you know, Kader for Kader Azmal, etc. She was fine until it got to the issue of, do you believe HIV causes AIDS? And then she introduced it like a good politician as a red herring, and then wouldn't answer the question, why are you calling me by my first name? Wouldn't answer the question if she believed HIV caused AIDS. The signal was bad. She was late because she'd gone to the loo. Yeah. We were out of time. And I said, I've never heard such rubbish. And I cut off the interview. I look back on it now, and I think the tone was appalling. And it did seem racist and hectoring and bullying and all sorts of things. But I'm not sorry for the message that came out, because it was one of the first people who stood up and said, end this madness. And a week later, Kader Azmal stood up and sort of put his hand above the or head above the parapet. And luckily, we've moved on from there.
And it will go down as one of the most embarrassing things that the Thabo Mbeki administration cannot atone for.
Absolutely. But one of the worst interviews that I've ever done.
But you know, John, you seem to be very bad at forgiving yourself.
Yeah, I am. I'm tough.
You're still upset about coming to tour the country during apartheid, which really I don't think anybody, when they see you, thinks, oh my God, that John Robbie.
But it's not about them, Gareth. It's about me.
Okay, I know.
That's the point. It's not about them. It's about me.
How have you – what is it that – and Manto, she's gone. Many other people died because of bad policy making under her. It was one interview. You had subsequent ones with people close to her. You spent enough time going over and over it in your head. I can only imagine.
Sure,
you don't want to let go and.
Yeah, no, no. But I mean, Gareth, I played sport at international level. I was a very good player when I was young. I was never quick enough or strong enough to be a great player. And yet, I played rugby for Ireland. I played rugby for the British Lions. I was on the bench for South Africa and played. And part of that was that same obsession with mistakes, getting it right, if you've done something wrong, trying to prove, etc. And I think that, in a way, carried through into radio. Yeah, shame. It's just the way I am, Gareth. Speak to my wife.
Yeah.
She says, I wish I was as sensitive about picking up towels and tidying up afterwards. But do you think
some of that is in your Irish blood?
I don't have a drop of Irish blood in me, Gareth.
Oh, come on.
I don't. I've got a Welsh mother and a Scottish father.
Really?
Absolutely. I don't have a drop of Irish blood.
You know,
in me.
I was, because Robbie's a Scottish surname.
Scottish name. My father, John Cameron Robbie from Airdrie. And he was in the Merchant Navy during the war and was a marine engineer. My mum was a school teacher from the Valleys, Dorothy Irene, Mary Richards. And they met and fell in love in the war. And then we had four babies in 4 years. Yeah. So he couldn't stay off in the Merchant Navy. And he got a job running the Guinness boats from Dublin to the UK that supplied Guinness Stout. So that's how I happened to be born and bred in Ireland. And the day I first played for Ireland, my father, who was a good Presbyterian from Glasgow, confided that his father, who I never met, thought the only good Irishman was a dead one. So I don't know. So the Irishness is a strange one.
So maybe that's the real imposter syndrome that we're talking about.
Maybe it's lack of identity.
Is that people think you're Irish and you're not. I worked with you and I didn't know this.
Well, I mean, I'm Irish because I was born and bred there. But in terms of, but in a funny way, Gareth, that's what was, how can I put it? The only reason I got on in radio was because you think back to the old, I mean, you hardly are old enough to remember the old South Africa. And the whole iniquity of apartheid was you were put in a pigeonhole.
Yeah.
You know, if you were Afrikaans and white, this is what people assumed you were. If you were black and Zulu and rural, this is what people assumed you were. If you were colored, I never know to say so-called colored or colored, which is a debate. This is what you come from, Cape, whatever. And suddenly, on this little radio show, 10 o'clock till midnight, there's this white rugby player who sounds like he's quite progressive. He speaks in a socialist way. He's clearly a guy. And as a result, I don't think in any other country in the world could somebody, an eightlander, and bear in mind, at that time, I'd been in the country, 8 years or something. I'd only been on radio for 4 years. Running this very, at the time of a potential civil war, you know, having strong views, telling people what to do, et cetera, et cetera.
You could have very well lit the party keg yourself.
And the only reason was because I was an outsider. Because I was an outsider, no one could put me into that pigeonhole. I don't think it would have happened in any other country. So I look back and say that, you know, maybe it was synchronicity, maybe it was fate, I don't know. But I look back in amazement.
Well, there's nothing about it that isn't amazing. And when it comes to sport now, I mean, for some reason, and people keep on saying John Robbie has the best point of view on anything to do with the doldrums that our Springboks are currently going through. Why is it that they have these bland, boring people commentating on rugby and talking about it on these magazine-type shows on South African television where no one really gives any opinion worth 2 seconds of your time, let alone the half hour that they extend the show to? And it's analysis and it's this and that. And you've got people with pointers and red marks on the screen. But you sit down, and I've heard you do this. You'll sit down the morning after on your show. You'll give a synopsis of it like that. You'll say, here's the reason we won. Here's the reason we lost. Here's what's wrong with it. And they don't put you on these shows. What the hell are they doing?
I've no idea, Gareth. I was on Boots and All for so many years. I was the original commentator, but I got dropped because of my 702 show, the early show. And Supersport lied about that, and I was dropped when I needed the money to pay the bond and educate the kids. And that's been dealt with. That was in the past.
Yeah.
And years later, they brought me back. And I became Boots and All, and I became the number one. I did the World Cup in I think it was 2007 when we were. I was the main guy on that stage.
The ratings were great. And it was terrific.
At a certain stage, I just stopped getting the call. I have no idea. Nobody from Supersport has ever told me. Nobody has ever said. I know once, before it ended, Boots and All had its 47,000th show or something because it had gone on for so long. And somebody said, well, let's bring back the old ones. And someone said, no, John Robbie's not coming on. I've bumped into people from Supersport since and said, you know, just tell me what the story was.
You
want to know why. And they said, oh, no, you're coming back. This, that, and the other, nothing. So I have no idea. So obviously, they either decided I wasn't good enough, they either decided I was too old, or there was some other reason. But to this day, I have never been told one reason why I don't get the call from Supersport anymore.
Ben and I talk about it often. He's a real sports fan. I'm not. And when I watch those shows, those post-match shows and all those, I can't. I mean, it's like putting me to sleep.
Yeah, I like Nick Mallett, I must say. I've had this fantasy sometimes of going to somebody, another station, and saying, why don't we do a halftime show? You know, we don't have the game, but we'll do a halftime show. And maybe people will turn over.
They will.
And watch the halftime show.
They
but,
will.
But we'll see. But rugby has moved on a lot. Rugby is now a much more complicated game.
Where are we now, John? Where are we now with the Springboks? Come on.
You know the latest directive that's come from Saru? That if the Springboks win the toss, they're going to do a lap of honour. You've heard that, eh? I'm only kidding.
No, because Ben and I talk about this all the time, about the quality of commentary. It's almost like they want it to be as bland as possible.
But I really think that is the case, because you can't manage talent like Nick Mallett. One of them's fine, but if you have John there as well, then they're going to go, oh, crap, now they're talking for long.
Yeah, Nick is an amazing
now
guy.
Now they're arguing with each other.
Nick, we go way, way back. They're the first time I met Nick Mallett.
No?
It was very, very funny. I for my sins, in a different life, captained Cambridge University in the varsity match against Oxford, and we beat them.
God, that's funny.
And the next year, Nick Mallett was playing for Oxford, yeah. And I'd left the university, and the tradition in those days was they invited the previous year's captain to be their linesman. And I came back as linesman in my blue blazer with my blue scarf and my flag in front of, 50,000 people at Twickenham. And it was a shocking game. It was a shocking game in the wet, and Oxford won by 8-3 or something. But at one stage, and I'd never met Nick Mallett before, he was playing for Oxford. I was the Cambridge linesman. And Oxford piled into a ruck right near the line in the corner. And the edge of the ruck was in touch, but the ball was still in play.
Right.
So it was in play. And like 90% of the players, I didn't know all the technical laws. And that applies today. So I put my flag up.
Yeah.
So I denied Oxford. And it must have looked like the worst cheating ever. So next minute, live on television in front of 50,000 people, Nick Mallett comes storming down. I've got my flag up like this. And he started saying, you effing cheat. You. And he's about 8 foot tall, you know.
Yeah.
And I was under a slight bit of pressure now in front of all these people. So I said to him, Nick, if you take one step nearer, I'm going to shove this flag where the sun doesn't shine. And the ref came in and stopped the whole thing. And anyway, the game went on and Oxford won. In the dressing room afterwards, I went up the referee, Jack Short from Scotland, and I said, I was right about that decision, wasn't I? And I'll never forget, he looked at me and said, no. And Nick Mallett always says, at least I came to him and apologized in the dressing room afterwards, and we're great friends to this day. Nick's a good guy.
do a lot of people think that you are combative, that you're belligerent? And I think that...
I hate confrontation.
You do, exactly.
I hate it. I'm a pleaser. I don't like confrontation.
But people think you're the opposite. I don't know if it's, if it's a tone thing or if it's a misunderstanding or... there are very few people, and you're very sensitive to a lot of things. You don't like upsetting people.
No, absolutely not. But I think Gareth, in the early days, and again, it came from basically 702 making up as they went along, and there was very little real mentoring of people. It's so different now. And it's not taking away personality. But I had this sort of idea that if you had a view and a strong view, you had to convert people. Whether they were listeners, whether there was, you had to convert people, and you would have convert. Now, I suppose you call it experience. You realize you don't. You can get the facts one side, speak to somebody the other side, let people make up their own mind. You don't have to ram it down people's throats. And that's why I listen back to some of the early stuff and cringe.
Have you got your own recordings?
None. Oh, no, burnt, yeah, gone. Yeah. The Nazis had nothing on me with books, with recordings. They're absolutely gone. But the one thing that I've done, and I'm proud of, at 702, a station that I love, and it's been the most amicable parting of ways, because, as you know, it rarely happens in this business.
No, most
when,
of the
when
time
people
go,
it ends up in tears. Yeah, it does. There's no question. And this whole thing has been so amicable. But the one thing I've done is, and I'm proud of it, is that any new people in 702 who've got enthusiasm, I've gone to them and said, look, I'm available. Anything you want to run past me. And that was one of the nicest things, because so many people in 702 in the last show, and also afterwards the last show, and the staff meeting that we had, which was fantastic, came up with me and remembered incidents that where I'd said, look, what about this? And that was kind of nice. You know, it made me feel very, very old, but it was kind of nice. I'd always rather that things get settled amicably. But if it comes to this, you know, if it comes to the real crunch, ultimately you have to look good yourself. And if somebody is being absolutely stupid, then occasionally you have to put them away.
You wake up every morning when you're doing a show like that, and you come in and you have your team. And I mentioned to you, Mabali and I have been working together for a long time. But
your team are fantastic, by the way. I've got to know them, and what a nice bunch of guys and ladies.
Mabs, say thank you.
Thank you.
Come
on. I was going to. Don't do that.
I'm not going
to
comment on your hair, though.
But you know what? You used to sit opposite Darius Opamotile.
Ah, right? Gee whiz. Yeah, what a man.
A man who, like me, is a big Sundown supporter.
Yep.
And someone who really you develop a family kind of relationship.
27 years we worked together.
As long as Madiba was in prison.
Absolutely. And they called it life, hey?
So when you two don't see each other every day anymore.
No.
But there's definitely some kind of connection. Are there other people like that you'll still want to see, you'll have to go for a lunch with every now and then because you want to keep up with.
Absolutely.
In radio, there are some people.
Absolutely. I mean, I can honestly say, I think that I don't have an enemy in the building in 702. But I also know from my rugby days that when you retire from rugby, the tendency is to go back, to pop into the dressing room afterwards, to pop along. And I said no. So what I've done now is I'm going to make a complete break from 702. You know, there are obviously issues admin I have to deal with, pension issues, things like that. You know, so I've got to have contact. But I've consciously said I'm not going to go in, and I'm not going to do it for six months, whatever. And I miss it, and I miss the gossip. You know,
when I left 5FM and when I left FM radio.
Yeah.
I decided I wasn't going to listen anymore because not because I don't like them or because I don't know what they, you know, that they're doing better now or whatever else it might be. For me, it was that I didn't want to have, when people come up and ask you, well, you know, we miss you, and they say this to you now, and it's not the same without you. You can honestly say, I don't know because I haven't been listening, but thank you. That's nice of you to say without any interpretation.
I'm the opposite. Bitterness. 6 o'clock. On
You're
it goes.
Listening every
on
day.
It goes. Olani, thank you very much indeed.
Okay.
I hear it. Absolutely. I said almost the last thing I said was, you might have lost a morning show host, but you gained a listener.
You're very loyal.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a good quality to have. It's a very rare quality to find these days.
Yeah.
People don't stay in the same job for as long as you did.
I've only had, I think, 1, 2, 3, 4 jobs in my life. And I'm 61.
Well, listen, 61's not old.
New 40. 60 is the new 40, so they say.
And really, 61 is, these days, you know, you've got people in charge of big corporations in America who are in their 80s and even sometimes their 90s. You've got Bob Mugabe up the road here running the country at 94.
Allegedly,
Now, what are you going to do? Because, you know, some people would say your best years are still ahead.
Yeah, I don't know. Honestly, I don't know. I'm not being cagey. I've been in discussions with various people. I have a very serious job offer. Funnily enough, I'm having a meeting today about it. I had a rugby career. I had a radio career. I'm keen to do something different, just something completely different. I'm so optimistic about this country. I love this country. And I want to do something that makes a difference. And, of course, making a difference can be business. It can be creating jobs, creating wealth, creating products, selling products, etc. The biggest problem is that, as I said earlier, I'm institutionalized, so I don't know. I say I want to do something because it interests me when I talk about it on radio. Maybe when I'm down in the nitty-gritty, I'll hate it. Maybe I'll come back into broadcasting. I'm conscious that, I mean, 702 have been very, very generous. So in the immediate future, it's not like I have to, you know, go out on the street. Although when I finished, my wife as a present gave me a cardboard sign ripped up with crayons on it that says I used to have a talk show, so that when I go on the corner of Empire Road, I can hold it up there. That was, and I'm going to frame that because I love it to bits. But I honestly don't know what I want to do. There's certain interests I have. I'm talking to various people, and I honestly am not being coy.
No.
But I'd like to try something completely different. I'd like to make a little bit of money because, as you know, in this industry, we're the most underpaid people, professionals in the world.
Radio's always been the ugly child. child of the yeah. the media business.
No, I'm kidding. I was always paid very, very fairly by 702. So I don't know, but I'd like to make a difference. As I say, the things we talk about, that for all the controversies, the vast majority of people in this country are better off than they've ever been. They're more optimistic than they've ever been. They've got kids who are being educated, not perfectly. The annoying thing is things should be so much better. That's the really annoying thing. But anyone who says that the old South Africa was better in any way, shape, or form is stupid, unless they lived in a fool's paradise, which for many the old South Africa was. So I'm very keen to make a difference. I love tourism. Tourism is the great panacea to our
problems.
Did
you do a lot of traveling?
Not as much as I'd like, because I've been tied to the morning show. That's another reason why it's time to go. I mean, I've got two grandkids, and both my kids, sadly, but their choice, are living in London. So obviously, I mean, when you get kids, it's amazing, but nobody tells you when you get grandkids how just mind-blowing it is. So obviously, we want to go there. 702, I mean, I'll say it now, I always wanted to go to India. So as one of my gifts, 702 have given Jenny and I a trip to India, which I'm looking forward to just because it's this mind-blowing place that 50% of people come back and say they hate it, 50% come back and say they love it beyond. So I do want to do more traveling. That's one of the things I'd like to do. But the honest thing, Gareth, is I don't know. I don't know what I want to do. I'm going to be totally open with all potential employers, etc.
You don't have to rush to anything.
Yeah, well, you have to pay the bills, Gareth.
Yeah, but you don't have to rush because you've
Gareth, I'm scared and I'm being honest.
I know you
come away this last week was the first week, because everything else has been on holiday like a normal year. But this is the first week that I've been unemployed since I was 26 years of age.
And you like to have a plan.
And I like to have a plan. Exactly.
You like to know what's coming tomorrow and the next week. And
exactly. But there must be something.
And Jenny will go mad if you sit at home.
Oh, absolutely.
She'll hate you.
No, she'll slaughter me. She'll slaughter. I always laugh when people say, are you a gun owner? I said, you've got to be joking. Jenny would have shot me years ago if that was the case. So exciting times, scary times, but by nature, I'm an optimist.
Are you missing any part of switching on that microphone and sharing your ideas with the world?
I think yes. I mean, I am. I think that as you go through,
you're not going to do it on Twitter, are you?
Well, I know it's minor by your standards, but I mean, I've never sent a tweet in my life,
yeah.
And I've got 365,000 followers.
That's amazing.
I mean, what we did was, and I made it plain, you know, on the show, somebody would say the minister said this, John said, you know, information rather than opinion. So everyone tells me that this is an advantage that I've got to use, but you know, I'm not sure about that. But
Twitter themselves can't figure out how to turn that into anything useful.
Yeah, it's the worst. That kills me. Jane Morgan, who worked as my producer at one stage, lovely, lovely person, now lives down in Rhodes, I think. And
I spoke to her last year.
She came to the one and said, there's this new thing called Twitter. And I said, who comes up with these names? Twitter. It is so inane, so childish. She said, it gets worse because, you know, a communication is going to be called a tweet. Oh, and when people say, tweet me, when it just, you know, but maybe that's just proving my age, you know.
Oh, wow. No, I think, you know, you've got you've got a lot still to give. By no means this is, you know, the end of any kind of road, because I also think, you know, a new lease on life. Look at what you didn't know when you left rugby. You'd end up being in radio for as long as you were.
Absolutely. Never gave it a thought in my life. Ever. Ever gave it a thought. I resigned from Guinness's as a graduate trainee. That was like, you know, a road to security in Ireland. In an Ireland that was, you know, very poorly off economically. I resigned on a matter of principle overnight. Phoned up and said, they've said I can't go on this tour. And Jenny, and we were, you know, young kid, everything, battling to make a way, said, have you told them to F off yet, you know, in her inimitable fashion?
She's a powerful ally.
Oh, she is.
Ally.
She's fantastic. She's a rock.
John, what do you do when you're, besides read, I know you read a lot.
Yep.
What do you do when you've got a bit of time? It's a rare thing for you.
Yeah, a golf I'm passionate about. And after 15 years of pathetic, embarrassing misery, a friend of mine suggested a tiny technical change to my grip, and suddenly I'm playing golf again. So that's been a great joy playing a little
bit.
Ben,
you have an ally there.
Playing a little bit of golf to actually hit the ball has been fantastic. So I aim to play some golf. But you know, spending time with my wife, I mean, I drink. I enjoy drinking. Yeah, right. I mean, Uber has been just the most greatest thing. I've got a small number of really good friends, and we enjoy alcohol in the right way. We enjoy it. We enjoy partying. We have fun. And you know, looking at this eclectic group of friends that we have, some are billionaires, some haven't got two pennies to rub together, and yet we're all fantastic friends. I'm afraid the one thing we all have in common is that we enjoy alcohol, but maybe that's part of the Irish background. But
maybe.
But as I always tell my wife, I was a teetotaler till I met her.
Well, so she's the bad influence in that respect.
You can draw your own conclusion.
Good for both of you. Well, listen, anything to take the edge off sometimes, because you're very hard on yourself. You've got lots to be very proud of.
Yeah. You've
got great kids, great wife.
Thanks. I've got
great life.
You look at, I mean, we were at a funeral for a young kid who committed suicide this week. And it's happened a few times. And you know, kids, I used to get calls from listeners whose kids were into Nyaupe. Who are into, you know, this scourge that is out there. And somehow, I mean, my kids have just turned out to be the most beautiful, loving, naughty as hell, but minds of their own, but good hearts. And you know, I've said it before that I always remember Paul McCartney when Linda McCartney died. And he said we had a very simple philosophy. We broke down people, the human race, into a binary description. They either had good hearts or bad hearts. I've never forgotten it. Some of the greatest rogues that ever live underneath it all have got a good heart. And some of these church-going, pompous, you know, sanctimonious people actually underneath have got bad hearts. And I'm proud to say that both of my kids and my wife have got very, very good hearts. And I like to think I have as well.
Well, if they hang around with you, you must have. By association. Guilt by association.
Sorry, let me just adjust my halo there. I ain't no saint.
John Robbie, thank you so much for coming to talk to us this morning. It's been a long time since I've had a proper conversation with you, and I felt the poorer for it when it wasn't there.
Thanks, Gareth. It's an honor to be on your show, and well done with your career.
Thank you. John Robbie, everybody. CliffCentral.com.